Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Talk Openly. I'm Jack, and I'm here with my excellent friend Daniel.
Hi, Jack. It's so good to be on the line with you again.
It's always excellent. I look forward to Tuesdays. They're also the middle of my week. They're kind of like my Wednesday, and being able to talk with
Okay.
you on my Wednesday night is just like such a great way to kind of go into the last of my week. So
I love it. That's fantastic. It's not like the middle of my week, but it kind of feels like it. Yeah.
Nice. Well,
Yeah,
yeah,
how
we're
you
gonna
do it? How are you?
I'm good. Apparently I'm impatient to talk about our topic tonight.
Let's get after it. Come on, let's just jump right
Just
in. Never mind all the pleasantries. Let's just get into
jump
patience.
in. Which is like all of the paramitas that we've been going over, just a really massive topic. Like, we're only going to be just barely scratching the surface of our own experience with
Right.
patients. But I think it's going to be fun. There's a lot to work with here.
Indeed, indeed. It's sort of a limitless pool to swim around in, that's for sure. It's complex and like you said, we're barely scratch the surface. And that's speaking for myself anyway, with a very limited understanding and very little experience. So, full disclaimer there.
Totally. Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. Well, yeah, you were asking me before I tried to launch into patients how I'm doing. I'm good. Today was a hectic day. I woke up and it was already like it was I already felt stressed. But I had one of those meditations where I was like really trying to keep myself awake. I just kept reminding myself of, what Mama's been trying to, gently beat into my head, which is that, shamatha is just all about working with resistance. Whatever resistance shows up, like that's what I need to work with. And so this morning it was a lot of sleepiness. And so a friend of ours from Lion's Roar, Dirk, one time encouraged me to, focus on what does it feel like to be dull? What does it feel like to feel sleepy? So I just was, kind of examining that and noticing how it shifted. So it was an interesting sit. But yeah, then I went and did the thing of like having one coffee with breakfast and then going and I bought a coffee. I bought like a, however many shot latte. And so then my like anxiety was just amplified enormously. So I don't know why I did that. I was just like a weird, like impulse and very impulsive decision.
Well, it's like so many samsaric pleasures, right? Like you're like, oh, a little bit seems like nice and pleasant and helpful. So maybe if I have more of it, then it'll yield even better results. And then you realize, like, no, none of it works that way. There's literally there's no thing that works that way. There's this point of diminishing returns. And with caffeine, that point, at least for sensitive folks, is pretty early on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it was interesting to just kind of watch like how that substance as like, yeah, all substances that I've used in the past, really kind of plays on some of my like, most aggressive, I guess, ch mental challenges, right? So like, what am I worried about when I'm getting that kind of like hyped up anxiety? I was thinking about how like I had kind of dropped the ball on something, and that just whereas recently I've been really kind of calm about like taking accountability and being able to just be like, oh yeah, that's okay, I screwed up there, totally. I felt this kind of surge of like, oh, just like uh-oh energy inside of me. And it was just really interesting to watch that it was like, I wonder if I didn't have this substance inside of me, like coursing through me, would that experience have been like quite as intense? And ultimately it wasn't even really a big deal. So it was just kind of interesting to look at that.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is with increased mindfulness, you get really sensitive to just little shifts in consciousness, little shifts in the way that you're perceiving reality, right? Like, I've noticed that for sure. Like, just minor, like, oh, I'm like, you were talking about tiredness. Oh, I'm a little bit tired, or I'm strung out on caffeine, or I've had nothing to eat and except for some sugar or whatever. Yeah. There's these different things that can kind of like clue you in. They're like little dashboard lights, right? We become super sensitive to them. You know, though, I don't know about you, but my dashboard lights on my my super fancy minivan, they're on, and I still just keep on driving. So I think it's a little bit that way too. In this case, right? Like the same kind of thing happens with me, where I'm like, I know, like just like a nice cup of tea or maybe one cup of coffee will do me just fine. I know that, right? But yeah, inevitably I'm like, well, I do have this thing. I'm just gonna buy myself a coffee.
Yeah. So. I know. Yeah, it was just such a silly little moment. But now that it's over, it's like kind of fun to look back and see, okay, yeah, that's what happens when I use that substance kind of over, you know, over the top.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's all
just experimentation, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think at this time, it would be hard for me to imagine giving up caffeine completely. I don't see that in my near future. But yes, to kind of just everything in moderation, as they say.
Well, you know what's kind of amazing about that? I think it's funny because I have on occasion given up caffeine for periods of time. And what I notice actually is after this sort of maybe a small discomfort of like a couple of days at the most, a little headache or something, what I actually notice is incredible calmness, right? Mm-hmm. Like just sort of like much more subdued. And what I recognize is that that calm sort of slightly subdued state, isn't like what I want, right? I kind of want to get hyped up. Right. Like I got to get some wind in my sails, so to speak. Right. It's funny. And then we get sort of identified with that sort of aggressive or energetic state. Maybe it's not aggressive, but sometimes
it stimulated.
Stimulated. Right. Right. We get identified like, oh, stimulated. That's what I am. That's what I like to be, is stimulated. Yeah. Right. And then when you lose the stimulants, whatever they happen to be, whether they're the super strong ones or the more milder ones, you realize like, oh, actually, all these things that I identified with as being me, this anxiety or this sort of stress state, this high energetic state, that's not really like me. That's just like, that's like a biological thing.
That's so interesting. So you're kind of opening my eyes a little bit to some experiences that I had when I was younger. Like I really wanted to get on an ADHD medication.
Yeah.
Turns out I just wanted to get high, right? Like I really, you know, I would use my friend's ADHD medication for school and partying and stuff. And I would really, like what you said, you identify with it. Like I really saw myself as like, I like the me that is like up and kind of like can engage with people.
Yes.
Like I'm talkative, I'm creative, I'm, you know, like sexy and fun.
Yeah.
And I thought like, okay, well, that's the me that I want, you know, like that's the me that I really am if I just have ADHD medication, you know?
I know. Oh my God, Jack, you know, when I said the harder stimulants, I was talking about the exact same situation, identical to what you just described, right? Identical. Yeah. And it was everything about what you just said, I could have said the same thing.
Yeah.
And this exact same sort of like, oh, that's what I want to be, this strong, powerful, smart, engaging, you know, go, go, go. Right. Mm-hmm. And actually all of the stimulants kind of do that on a different level. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of interesting when we let go of overly stimulated selves or even overly entertained or overly anything. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Then we see sort of like how things are, and it oftentimes is like not as bright, you know, is maybe a little bit more dull. And there we really, you know, it's helpful to learn to be okay with that and to accept it. And actually, I think, you know, to borrow another a phrase from a great teacher, Tenzin Choki, right? About really relishing or savoring the okay, right? It's fine.
It is like gorgeous. Like when like I really like today, I had this moment where I was walking to the hospital, and I could really just sense the feeling of fall. Like everything around me was just like, there was kind of this swirling wind and there were leaves, and you could see, you know, Mount Rainier was in the backdrop, and there were clouds in the sky, and everything was just like, wow, this is fantastic. And it was, I really actually felt this deep appreciation for my Dharma practice. But it was like, oh, I can totally feel this right now. This is gorgeous. And if I had been using stimulants, you know, what I would be searching for is that kind of like, I don't know, like the music and like friends and, you know, just entertainment and all this stuff. But like, turns out we can just so deeply enjoy a walk down the block, you know, that it's just incredible.
Truly.
Thank you for prompting that discussion. Yeah,
thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. How are you? What's going on in your world?
I'm good. Pretty mellow, and I like it that way. Things are going pretty well. My meditations are a little bit longer than they used to be, and I'm finding that to be quite a blessing. Like just a little bit longer, but it really helps me to really settle in and just see a little bit clearer what's going on in my mind, right? Yeah, it's not like super noisy up there, but you know, like it's been pretty remarkable actually how I've only added maybe I think like 6 minutes to my practice, so not much at all, but it's made a pretty big difference. So I'm enjoying my meditations, and life itself is not too overly problematic to the degree that it has highs and lows. I think it's kind of like I'm kind of taking it in stride. You know, so it's good. Yeah, nothing too exciting to report though, Jack.
Well, I'm curious, you know, that 6 minutes can, you know, when you're on the cushion, that for me, that can feel like a pretty significant addition. Like from 24 minutes, which is my norm in the morning, to 30, like that, that actually feels like quite a lot to me. So I'm curious what you said that you have noticed a difference.
Yeah, that's precisely actually what I've done. I've gone from 24 to 30. And first of all, that extra 6 minutes does not feel like much. It's weird. Actually, I've never had this feeling before, but there's a feeling of like, just a little bit longer. Just a little bit. And I noticed that I'm not as quick to get up from my cushion. So once the meditation's over, I'm a little bit more inclined to just kind of like stay there for a minute and like just kind of wrap things up properly or whatever, right? And so there's actually this odd feeling of like, I'd like to actually do this longer. And what helps with that is I think it largely is being comfortable, right? Like in the past I've sometimes, you know, adopted postures that were a little bit maybe strict on myself or whatever, trying to force something. And I could tolerate it for a period of time, you know, but at some point I'd get like physical discomfort. And what I realized is like, no, I don't have to, it doesn't have to look a certain way, right? It has to work, right? It doesn't have to look a certain way. It has to be functional, right? And to that, like, it's been really helpful to find a way to get solid support without straining my body. And I find that helps a lot. And I'm meditating early in the morning. I was just asked yesterday, like, how can you wake up, you know, so early and not fall asleep while you're meditating? And I've never had that. Like I notice like when I have this intention to meditate early in the morning, I'm awake. Like I'm very like I'm there, you know. And I used to say like, yeah, early morning meditations, it's so great because it's oftentimes, like if you just got out of bed, a lot of times the mind's not super busy yet, right? And it's like kind of calm already. So you know, like it's not so disturbed, right?
Well, it's funny, I'm not that way.
I just want to say I'm wrong for the record. It's not, the mind is never a certain particular way all the time, even early in the morning. Sometimes they're pretty raucous, you know, mm-hmm. the mind gets a little loud, like right off the bat and starts going crazy with all kinds of planning and thinking about stuff or, oh my gosh, all kinds of things. So yeah, I was wrong about that. It's not always calm.
Well, it's funny, mine in the morning, because I've been getting up early as well and find that typically I can be pretty alert. But what I noticed too, what happens, because I start out with like some prostrations, I do some other kind of physical activities, and then I do the prayers, and then I do a little bit of reading. And I noticed by that time, like somehow my mind has somewhat slipped back into like feeling tired. It's almost like I had the adrenaline to wake up and now I'm kind of settling in. I'm in my cushion. I'm next to my little space heater and I'm a little bit like kind of cozy. Yeah, okay. And it's almost like my brain, like I'll have these thoughts, you know, in meditation, of course we have thoughts, but they're almost like the kind of like bizarre, like where you're kind of slipping into sleep thoughts.
Sure. Like dreamlike, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of interesting to track where it's like, hey, I've just been doing all this preparation for meditation and now my mind is like going to sleep. So it's just something, another thing to work with, right?
Well, yeah, you know, though. So what's fun about that, I've often, dreamlike states have been sort of a challenge for me throughout my entire meditation career, if you will. But what I notice now actually is this, it doesn't actually really matter the content of the thought, like whether it's planning for work or whether it's sort of dreaming some nonsensical thing or whatever. What I'm noticing actually is that I'm getting hooked, right? That something is hooking me and pulling me along, and I'm able to come back and be, and just recognize like, oh, right, I just got pulled by that, right? I followed that little, you know, somebody threw the stick and I went chasing after it, mm-hmm. right? No matter what kind of stick it is, right? Like sometimes it looks a little different, the form's a little different, but sort of the process is the same, you know, I still need to just recognize and just come back.
Yeah, find the balance, whatever's needed. Yeah, definitely. Exactly. Nice. Well, that's really cool. I'm glad to hear about your, the shifts in your meditation. Adding on a little bit is always interesting.
It is. I'm hopeful, you know, like what I got to admit, I'm kind of like hopeful for like a day where nobody's home and I don't have work and there's no nothing. And just like kind of go long, like go kind of as long as I can just to see, just like a nice long, just one long sit, see what happens. Yeah. Or take, you know, Lama's advice is also to take little breaks. So maybe do like a long one and take a little walking meditation break and come back and do it again.
Like a little mini retreat. A couple times, especially as I was first starting to meditate, where I kind of was in the zone of like, I really want to like do this thing, you know. I think it was actually a really good schedule. Like I would go somewhere peaceful and I would do like an hour long sit and then I would walk a little bit and I'd come back and do like another hour and then like walk. And then do some reading. It was kind of crazy. Like I can't imagine doing that now. I think it was like a beginner mind thing or something. But I did in my hour was I would have little bells at 15 minutes. And that was just like a nice, like, okay, you're still doing it. You've got a little bit of a sense of time. So you don't have to like look, you know, or feel like you have to look. Right. So I think that was interesting. And you know, talk with Lama. I don't know if he recommends that. He did say he appreciated that I did the 15-minute little time stamp. So
always good advice, Jack. Check with Lama.
Like you check with your doctor, you know, don't follow any medical advice unless how you talk to your doctor. Yeah, Lama's the doctor. Lama's the spiritual doctor for sure.
That's right.
Oh man. Well, yeah, speaking of medicine, I think we should do a little bit of Dharma practice.
Dharma practice.
Yeah.
All right. That's what we're here to do.
Let's get into some Lojong.
Let's do it. I'm going to share my screen and For those who cannot see the screen, we're looking at the lionsroardharmacenter.org random Lojong slogan page, which I cannot recommend more highly. By the way, actually, you know what's really neat is the lionsroardharmacenter.org website also has a place where people can donate in case they feel
they
so
sure do inclined. Yeah.
So, you know, two birds, one bush right there. Get some Lojong slogans and make a donation.
I like two birds, one bush. That's so much sweeter.
Oh, wait. The two birds. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
No, it's good.
I'm trying to be more peaceful, Jack.
Yeah, absolutely. What my partner says is two birds, one seed. So feed two birds with one seed, which actually, you want to give them two seeds. Anyway.
Yeah, but they can share those seeds in the bush, in the one bush.
There you go, yeah. Well, let's check this out. So number 8, 3 objects, 3 poisons, 3 seeds of virtue. So I'm going to jump down to what Traleg Kyabgon writes. So he says, this slogan says that we can transform the objects and poisons into virtue. Instead of seeing virtue as something totally unconnected to vice, we can cultivate virtue from the soil of our negative tendencies by relating to the object of our emotions in a different way.
That is Dharma practice right there.
Yes, yes.
That's what we're talking about. That's the transformation.
Yeah, there. I wanted to see, was there a little bit more up there? There's quite
yeah, here a we go. Oh, yeah, look at that. There we go.
Yeah, so to most of us, there are 3 types of people and objects. Those we like, those we don't like, and those we're indifferent to, or some variation of the 3. Those are the 3 objects. And the 3 poisons are, ignorance, attachment, aversion. And the 3 virtues are the opposites of the 3 poisons. So that's prajna, wisdom, dana, generosity, and metta, loving kindness.
Ooh. Yeah, I love this. I absolutely love it. And what we're talking about tonight is how to transform the poison of aversion or hatred and anger and hostility.
That's right.
Into the virtue of loving kindness or non-hatred, yeah. Using patience. So how cool is that? This is good stuff. It's similar to, we've talked about before, the peacock eating the poison, right, and turning it into its colorful feathers and its sustenance.
Yeah, like how can we transform confusion and desire and hatred? How, you know, those things that can, you know, like you said earlier, when we get tugged, you know, maybe by a thought or whatever, of course our emotions are very much can get a grip on us. So, you know, instead kind of noticing it as an experience rather than reality can really be incredible. And I certainly have not mastered it, but when I have noticed that, I've been able to just kind of like, wow, can I experience the rush of anger,
yeah,
and just feel it kind of flood my body and kind of take over my mind for a moment and just recognize that that experience without acting on it. It's just a whole different beast. And I end up, you know, not harming myself or others by taking a pause. So yeah, that, I don't know if that's necessarily transforming it, but it certainly is taking a look at it without, you know, engaging or, you know, reacting to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a process, isn't it? The transformation. Yeah, sure. I don't think that it's just like in and out, right? You can't just flip the switch. No. It'd be nice if we could, but I think that we're going to have to do a little bit of work and a little bit of processing in order to engage in this transformation. But thank goodness that there's a well-defined process for doing it. We don't have to reinvent.
Right. And that's another thing that I love about this slogan is, you know, it just highlights how incredible our lineage masters are. It is, you know, they were able to break these things down into these, you know, kind of like bite-sized but so potent teachings for us. Yeah. Like I can remember these things, you know, and it's a system. So where it's not, when I, you know, the world is bewildering at times and our emotions are bewildering. And so like to have this kind of structure is just so, I mean, it helps me feel so centered, right? To know that I don't have to do this alone. There's incredibly wise and kind people who want me to succeed, and they've written down the ways to help me succeed. So
in many different ways. If you don't get it this way, you'll get it this other way.
Right. How compassionate, you know?
Like, I know, right?
Just the vast ways that the Dharma has been taught by our various teachers. Like it's just incredible that they do this for us. You know?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. The idea, the concept of having some gratitude for these teachings, right? It's because I was thinking, like, I was like, yeah, it's hopeful. It's so hopeful, right? Like, it's something that, you know, certainly in the past, before I came to Buddhism, you know, the idea that these terrible feelings and sort of behavioral patterns, reactive patterns, and all of that, that they felt so solid and real and like they were always going to be there. And there was no hope at all, right? Like there was this sort of certainty of it always going to be like, I'm always going to be this angry and this irritable and this restless and this dumb.
Yeah.
You know, right? but no, actually there is hope. There's good news here that there is impermanence and things can change.
Right. There's liberation. We do not have to be enslaved to this. And that's, yes, it is hopeful. And I think this is a good segue into our topic for tonight, because, you know, you were mentioning, like, it's going to take a while, right, for most of us to get this stuff, to really understand and be able to live it. And so, you know, there's different types of practitioners and levels of practitioners. And, you know, some of them are the very rare handful can like immediately with like teachings from their teacher can, you know, attain enlightenment and all the realizations of the path, you know, thus the immediate practitioner. And then there's the rest of us who are going to be on a much more gradual path. And there's like different levels of practitioner within that. But, you know, there's part of me who really just wishes, right, that I was that really quick, you know, immediate enlightenment person, right? Like, I don't want to have to go through lifetimes of working on this stuff. And at the same time, like, I know that there's no other way but to just continue with what I'm doing.
Right.
And I know that that requires a lot of patience, this quality that we're going to be learning about tonight. So, yeah.
I like how the idea of the continuity of consciousness or multiple lifetimes. Actually, I like the relationship between that and patience, because there is this sort of certain, there's this part of me that recognizes like, man, I got a long ways to go, like a really, I don't know if I'm going to make it in this lifetime. In fact, one of our Sangha members gave a talk recently and asked the audience, how many people here believe that they can achieve enlightenment in this lifetime? And of course, lots of hands went up because we are in a Vajrayana a Sangha.
Yeah.
I did not raise my hand. I did not, because I really was just checking with myself and I was like, oof, no, man, I it'd be nice. It's like, that's great. Like you, like, I'd love to sort of snap my fingers and just all of a sudden. But I recognize it's going to be a while. And I like the idea, I like the effect anyway of contemplating sort of time on a grander scale than just my own individual life. And I like how that affects I'm like, oh, right, I can actually keep going. I can like save the game, so to speak.
Yeah.
play again, right?
Yeah.
And keep, hopefully if I play my cards right, I'll be able to continue to practice Dharma.
Yeah, and really relying on the spiritual master to pull us through as we're learning. Yeah, you know, it's interesting as I was doing a little bit of studying for this tonight. Once again, I was surprised by kind of the definition that I got from different sources. Like it was a little bit different from my kind of how I tend to think of patience. You know, patience for me is kind of like, okay, I can put off doing the thing that I'm wanting to do. That, you know, feels like patience. And I certainly think that there's a lot of that in the Dharma. But what, you know, the general sense that I got with it, it's more so the ability to not be perturbed by anything. That was a definition that I saw. The ability to what you're actually putting off is your reaction to something that is normally very activating.
Yes, right.
So that was interesting to see that.
And it's not passive. That's the other aspect of patience, at least in my worldview. Patience is sort of, it's kind of passive. But what we're talking about does not really involve any passivity at all. In fact, it's very active. It's very engaged. It's incredible. You have to be aware, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as this kind of like, you know, development of perfections, you know, I think this like ability to put off reacting, as it becomes more perfect, right? Like more aligned with like how a Buddha would actually, you know, be patient, is that it just becomes natural to not feel like you need to respond. Because there, like everything that's tied to wanting to react or respond is tied to the self. As I've been doing a little bit of reflecting, it's like, okay, what makes me impatient? You know, what makes me feel that urge to be like, oh, wait a minute, no, you know, like, and it all comes back to me defending the self.
Or, oh, you know, my like, God.
Right? Yes, like, or in some way trying to assert myself because I feel like I need to get in there and let people know what's going on.
Okay, so that was something that I had not connected the dots with regard to patience at all until just today. Like what you said, okay, I gotta riff off of this for a little bit.
Yeah, please.
So I was listening to a Dharma talk by Reverend Shiko from Shasta Abbey, okay? And it was exactly what you just said, right? And it just clicked. She was reading something, and I wish I knew who the author was or what book she was reading from. But I'm gonna, if you don't mind, I'm gonna read it, what she said, because it's exactly, it felt like one of those mic drop moments, you know? Like where it was, she's like, oh, nothing, say no more, right? It was this aha moment, okay? So she was reading. She says, each of us will understand patience in our own way. This is because none of us needs to be patient, except insofar as we have a false sense of self that feels the need to endure something it doesn't like. Bodhisattvas have no need of patience. Advanced practitioners enjoy insults because they provide an excellent chance to learn and improve. Some people want to fight when they are insulted. Others want to cry. Others want to justify themselves. The responses are many. The cause is but one. The illusion of self has been stimulated to defend itself against a well-aimed attack. And the cure is to understand that there's nothing to be attacked. There is nothing to be attacked and there is no attack. Both of them are empty. You cannot feel insulted unless you are deluded. All anger is an illusion. To understand this is to understand the highest form of patience. At its highest level, patience is just another word for wisdom. The patience isn't even needed except for the fact that you're deluded.
Right.
Oh, like I had not, like, it really was this sort of aha. I was like, oh, I did not get that part.
Right. Well, I think that is what all of the six paramitas are moving towards, right? That like
right.
actually an enlightened being doesn't need any of these things because an enlightened being is not deluded. Like there's no need for patience or generosity or ethical discipline because that's just natural. That's just what happens. That's how you're going to engage with the world and other beings. Wow, there's some good stuff in there.
Yeah, I loved it. It really it, like shook me. I listened to it a few times. And I was like, right. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And just how that, that devil of the self just really, really like, lies to us and is so good at it. You know, like I really have, I have this little beast. I just like this little beast inside me that comes out when I feel like someone is, you know, maybe misunderstanding me. Where it's like, or they're kind of misquoting me. That's something that really bothers me. Like, you know, at work, if I feel like someone's kind of misquoting, like how I'm working with a patient or, you know, whatever else it might be, I feel this really strong need to be like, oh, wait a minute. No. Like, that's not what I'm doing. Right. And you know, in some ways that might be like, technically I should do that and share, like, here's how I'm working with this patient, but there's something else there. It's not like, you know, I think, you know, I can imagine Lama in his kind of clinical work doing the same thing, being like, actually, here's what I'm doing. But it wouldn't be coming from a place of like, I don't want you to think that way about me, you know?
Like, it would just be correction.
It would just be correction. Yeah. Yeah. Right. 100%. but yeah, that little demon that just really feels like it needs to protect and defend and what happens in those situations when that kind of impatience arises when I'm not skillful is that I end up feeling pretty embarrassed, right? With like and the insecurity is just like revealed, right? and so, you know, I think a part of patience that feels really accurate to me is that patience comes from a real deep confidence in the truth, which is that, you know, there's just nothing here to defend. You know, there's just nothing here. Right. And so that feels really interesting to me too, the confidence, the natural confidence that arises as we develop our wisdom around that there is nothing to defend.
There's nothing being attacked and there is no attack.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't know though. Do I really buy that?
I don't know. Do you? Tell us more.
No, I'm just kidding. But you know, there's a sense like when it's happening. So when I'm provoked and I feel defensive or impatient, I feel justified. It feels very real, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not a big, that feeling of sort of deflating it in the moment sometimes feels almost disingenuous, like I'm betraying myself, right? Mm-hmm. Which I am. But right, but there's this sort of feeling sometimes of like, oh man, no, I want to hold on to this, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like in meditation, getting hooked, right? I get like hooked by something, and then I don't really want to let it go, and then sometimes I'll notice like, oh, sort of, you know, like I'm looking at it and I'm realizing, oh, well, it's not, you know, whatever, there is no attack, and I'm not, what, there's nothing to be attacked. Sort of like I recognize that sort of perspective is beginning to sort of creep in a little bit. And there's another part of me, this sort of self that wants to be like, no, right? I want to hold my ground. I want to defend my space, right?
Yeah.
And what I perceive as having been wronged in some way.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I experienced this exact same thing last night of that, thinking of like trying to turn the mind towards Dharma, And then that self wanting to come back in and be like, like you're getting screwed over here, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there is. I love that I have the partner that I have, because he's so patient. He's a very patient person. We had this conversation last night where I just felt really frustrated with how he phrased something about like my physical health, basically like something that I've been dealing with the last few months. And I was just like, don't tell me what to do with my body. You know, like I've already told you my plan, and like, I don't need to hear anything, right? Like I'm good, you know? And then I gave it we had like a moment where I just kind of like paused. And then, you know, I kind of shared like, you know, this is kind of where I'm coming from. Like, I feel really triggered when people tell me what to do with my body. And, you know, we just kind of left it at that. Right. And then I went and like was doing a workout, and pretty much the whole time I was just thinking like, how can I explain why this happens? You know, like, why does this feel so like intense to me? Cause I feel like I really got to get it across to him why this is such a strong reaction for me. But then there was also the Dharma was coming in, and I was like, it's actually not necessary. Like, you don't need to prove anything. Like, you don't need to explain the points about gender and patriarchy. Like it's just like, stop, you know?
Yeah, you do.
I mean, that's what I felt. Was like, that's what was coming in so strong, that it was like, Jeff, this is about gender. This is about the patriarchy. But I think that's that, you know, that while those things, like those are things are historical truths, right? They're also things that my ego can latch onto and say, I can use that to reinforce the self. And I don't need to do that. Right. I don't need to do that. And we didn't have any more conversation about it. And so I feel better about that, actually.
it's kind of interesting, though. I think that what you're pointing to is something that I find kind of cool, which is that dropping it, letting it go, was again not a passive experience.
No,
you had to. You actually had to engage with yourself and your thoughts. You know what was going on in your mind, your emotional state, all this stuff. You had to think about the patriarchy. You had to think about gender, and that actually sort of points to the fact that it's actually by like sort of trying to understand the whole situation, right? Seeing it way bigger, not such a narrow scope, right? Like you actually have to sort of back out, and then you see it within context. You know, including from within a Dharma lens, right? And you see this like additional context, you get this greater perspective. And as a result, as a natural result of that greater understanding, that greater perspective, you can kind of breathe out, let it go, right? Yeah. But you can't just breathe out and let it go. Right? Yeah. You can't just like push it away. That's aversion, right? That's not going to help anything, right? So you actually have to turn around and face those demons and look at them.
Yeah. That's such a great point. Yeah, that letting go is not passive. It's in fact extremely difficult.
That's right.
At least right now, you know, while I'm, you know, not a bodhisattva.
Because so much of it has to. So what we're talking about is like in these situations, so much of it, your partner loves you, right? Is not trying to harm you in any way, shape or form, right? The one thing that's been bothering me lately, there are these street racers in the neighborhood that like to spin donuts and go drive really fast in residential neighborhoods or whatever. And it's for whatever reason provokes a great amount of anger, hostility, aggressive thoughts on my end, right? It's not personal. They don't even know that I exist.
Yeah.
Right. Like it has no, like, and my anger, my frustration, am I imagining all kinds of things happening to them, whatever? Yeah. None of that is doing anything but ruining my peace and happiness, right? Yes. Like literally. And so like, they're like, so in order, like that whole process of backing out, getting context is really depersonalizing it. It's not about this little me. That's what happens, right? It's so sharp. It's so focused. It's so intensely me. And then by backing up, by using these methods, by actually doing our training, applying, being, you know, practicing, can back up a little bit and see, like, oh, right, it's not me, it's not them. It just is how it is, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that was I was reading a little bit of Shantideva in preparation, right? Because I think it's all of chapter 6, right? It's about anger and patience.
There's two chapters, right? Isn't it one anger and another one patience?
You might be right. Totally. But you know, basically he writes a lot about this topic. And one that I thought was really interesting was he talks about, like, why get mad at the person beating you with a stick, right? You know, like, it's just the stick beating you. And then what that kind of like draws to is that also it's not the person beating you. It's like the causes and conditions controlling the person that's beating you as well. So you can like see all these different levels and see how like, wow, okay, how interdependent all of this is, this dependent arising, where it's like, you know, sure, it might be that there is some influence of like the history and generations of like of male domination that influences that conversation that we had, right? But it's just all like that's just what's happening, you know. And also like there's so many other factors happening there that are more important, like our relationship, you know? so it's, yeah, I love like breaking down the causes and conditions is infuriating actually for me because I want to find the enemy. I want to have the enemy to say, that's what the problem is. And turns out it's like, well, as we look, we kind of, it's just the infinite regress thing that our friend Connor was talking about on Sunday, where we can't find it. We keep looking and there's a cause for that and a cause for that and a cause for that. And we'll never get down to it. In fact, you know, if we could lay blame on one thing, it's like our ignorance.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, there is no enemy.
Well, yeah, well, interestingly, there is no enemy is the ultimate sort of aspect of it. Although I did write down a quote by the Dalai Lama that I enjoyed, which is, the enemy is the necessary condition for practicing patience. You know, and there you'll read this again and again and again from the various teachers, this notion of like, yeah, the ones who teach us patience, they are our greatest teachers. They are doing us the greatest service we could ever imagine, right? And that's sort of a tough, bitter pill to swallow because it's not just, I mean, yeah, okay, everyone, you know, some people through their suffering can teach us compassion and all. Yes, yes, okay. There's all kinds of teachers teaching all kinds of things, right? If we're open to it. But that this one particular thing, this that anger, because it is so incredibly destructive, it's actually the worst, right? The of all the disturbing emotions, right? Like anger is the most destructive. And therefore, those who come and teach us patience are our greatest allies. And that's a tough one, right?
Yeah.
Like I don't really like that truth.
Yeah, I don't like that one either. Yeah, it's one that I've been grappling with for a while and, you know, actually reflected on recently that I don't think I would have gone into the temple if it weren't for my worst enemies.
Ooh.
You know, like I...
Ooh, talk about that.
Yeah, I won't get into too much detail, but Yeah, at the time that I went into the temple, I was really, really struggling with some severe anger, like even homicidal rage against some people who had done some very harmful things. And I just knew that I needed something to bring me some peace, you know, that's what I wanted. was I you know, if I don't find some peace of mind, like I'm going to go crazy. And it really disturbed me recently to think, I don't know if I would have gone to the temple if I didn't have these so-called enemies, right? Yeah. And when I look at their causes and conditions and think about, you know, what causes people to do harm, you know, like what influences people to do harm? It's the very same things that have caused me to do harm.
Yeah.
You know, that all the different kinds of harms, you know, there's so many. And so, yes, to recognize that, like, I can't hate people, you know, it's the exact same, you know,
that's how you got there, right?
Yeah.
That's what caused it in the first place. You were harmed because of somebody's hatred or anger, right? And then your own hatred or anger is just going to perpetuate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, like, maybe, yeah, the patriarchy, because this is also this experience is related to kind of patriarchal stuff. This is a thread for me. This is like something that I get to work with, right? Yeah. It's like, oh gosh, like how do I get to learn how to, how to work with and understand men, right? Wow. You know, like that's really important. And yeah, how can we all liberate ourselves from these harms that we do to one another? I want us all to be free, you know, so that we can stop harming one another. But yeah, that takes some forbearance. Like, okay, I'm not going to react, because that's just going to keep that ball rolling, in that destructive karma.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think, you know, you alluded to this at the outset, which is that the topic of patience is, it's deep, right? Especially as we're talking about it as one of the paramitas. And mostly the kind of patience I feel like that we've talked about is related to harm, right? Not being bothered by harm. And I had noted actually this Shantideva, he talks a lot about anger and patience, right? And he broke it down into like three types of patience.
Yeah.
One is the one that we've mostly been talking about, right? People harming us or harming others, right? And having this habitual angry reactivity. But there's a couple of other types of patience that they brought up, and I was hoping that maybe we could talk about them briefly. One of them being the patience of readily accepting suffering.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's just the, like, that's sort of what you're talking about, like with the patriarchy and all of that. Like there is actual suffering happening, has happened, you and others. And there's a certain amount of acceptance that's, you know, related to that. Right. And and we're not talking about indifference, right? Right. Or that we want more suffering, but there's an acceptance of the truth of suffering. We have right. to. Right.
And this is the world that I'm in, you know, like exactly. I'm not going to change it in a day. This is the water that I'm swimming in. Yeah. That kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And not only that, but then the third type of patience that he mentions is the patience of bearing hardship while engaging in Dharma practice. And I think that what I think is really helpful for me to remember is, no one promised me a bed of roses on this path, right? And no one said it was going to be easy. And no one promised that it was all going to be like peachy keen and I was going to love everybody and everybody was going to love me, right? Like there's going to be difficulty. There are obstacles. That's the whole point, right? Just like the, you know, the Lojong slogan was talking about is that there will be challenges. We have obstacles. And our job is to learn to work with those obstacles and turn them into supports.
Yeah.
Right. And so like, yeah, developing patience it's so important and it spans different, you know, it encompasses different aspects of our life and our training. And I love the subject matter. I feel like, man, maybe a couple more weeks of talking about it would be fantastic.
I know. Yeah, we could definitely talk about each of those practices of patience. And how the Lam Rim, this kind of gradual path and meditations on the path, can really, I think, be such strong antidotes for the anger that gets inflamed. Like I feel that the meditation on exchanging self with others, which I know we've talked about, you know, and we talked about how it can be a little bit tricky to understand what that might actually mean. But Thupten Chodron has, I think everyone should get this book and listen to these meditations. She has guided meditations on the Lam Rim. And so there's one on exchanging self with others. And I really feel that this is such a good antidote for anger, for rage, you know, where we can just, and imagining taking on suffering. So to also Tonglen, I think is such a strong antidote for anger and developing patience, you know. And I'm sure that you can vouch for this too. I feel this slow, it's like, you know, it feels somewhat glacial, but these slow shifts in my relations with others, where I can just feel this kind of like, oh yeah, I don't need to react to that. You know, there's no need.
Yeah. Well, both that what you just said, which is there is actually a change, but also an awareness of where there still is, you know, room for more change. Because like, it's sometimes like I have, kind of like you were talking about with your partner, these moments where I am reactive, right? And I do get hooked. And just like my meditation, it's really important to see that that's what's happened and to come back, right? Yeah. And recognize and be like, and just like you do that hard work of understanding, seeing it for what it is, right? Bring that into your meditation. And then you're like, oh, whew, wow, I can't believe that happened. But that's how the glacier sort of moves, right? Yeah. Over a long period of time. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about it. You know, I think what I'm going to do is the next time that I hear somebody doing donuts out of the intersection, what I'm going to remember, and I'm really hopeful that this will be true, but the next time they're out there spinning or racing down the street or whatever, instead of thinking about, you know, the spike strips that'll blow up their tires or the cops arresting them or any of that, I'm going to just be like, that is the voice of the Buddha right there.
Yes.
Right. And I'm going to use it just like one of those bells. And I'm going to use it, be like, come back. Like I'm not being attacked. They're not attacking me. There's nothing happening. You know, it's all right. It's
okay. Yeah, for right. Sure. Yeah. Well, and maybe what I can do, you know, every time I'm like annoyed by a man, any man, I can remind myself, you know, there is that there is a Buddha inside that person. That person has Buddha nature, you know, and it's just, it's covered up right now, just like mine is, you know, just like me. And all of us want to be happy. All of us want to be free.
Speaking on behalf as a representative of men everywhere. Jack, I want to thank you for seeing the Buddha nature in us. I appreciate that.
Daniel.
we need that. We need it. It's the only way that we're going to dismantle the patriarchy.
That's right. It is. Thank you. Yes. That is absolutely.
And now we're going to usher in the age of Aquarius.
Right? the age of Aquarius, the age of the Buddha. That's what we want, right? Or Vajrayogini.
Let's do it. Yeah. Some Vajrayogini and some Tara. Right?
Yeah. And no matter what gender you are, we are, you know, we all have Tara and Vajrayogini energy.
Absolutely.
Let's bring it out.
Thanks for reminding me of that, Jack. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Daniel, thank you so much. I have to say, like, something got kind of shook within me, shook up within me talking about some of that stuff, but in a really good way. You know, like you said, this path is not easy, but it's beautiful. And gosh, the rewards are just so vast, aren't they?
It's doable and you're doing it. So keep up the good work. I'll follow in your footsteps.
Oh, Daniel.
Right next to you.
All together. Yes,
we're all together. Right.
Okay, friends. Thanks all so right. much.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Next week, if you celebrate.
Happy Thanksgiving and all that. Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.